This is me talking. I will say nothing of value or merit.
You can start
and
again.
So it begins.
Rebecca, if we can get Rebecca off the bottle, she'll start editing that.
I'll pull it together.
Hello, everybody. You are listening to The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton. I happen to be Owen Edgerton. This is a KUT-produced podcast. Today, we're going to be talking to the novelist and short story writer, Doug Dorst. We'll be talking about spontaneity in writing, working with J.J. Abrams, and the mythos of the life of the author. It's going to be an excellent edition of The Write-Up, and I hope you stick with us. It's just the same as going to a cocktail party. Like, you know,
which is terrifying. So, I mean, let's be frank. Or being on a podcast, and I don't know what I'm going to say.
That's right.
It's going to make any sense.
Don't worry. This is that safe place where no one listens. So, you're fine. Of course, Doug, thank you so much for being here. Doug Dorst on The Write-Up. Doug, you listen to this podcast all the time, don't you?
Religiously.
All the time.
Yeah.
You've never listened to it. Well, instead of paying professionals to do well-thought-out book reviews, we call family and friends and find out what they're reading. And today we actually have a special book reviewer, someone who wrote me on Twitter and said, hey, I like it when you ask family and friends what they're reading. I'm reading a really cool book. So we've gone ahead and called up Ashley McKelvey. Ashley, are you there, Ashley?
I am.
Oh,
hi.
Ashley. Hi, thank you for taking a call and being on the Write-Up.
I'm excited to be here, I guess.
Oh, gosh, everyone's so enthusiastic about this show. It's really killing them across the airwaves. So, Ashley, what is the book that you've been reading? What are you going to tell us about?
I read this book. It's nonfiction. It's called The Skies Belong to Us by Brendan Corner. And it's about this crazy time in American history in the late 60s and early 70s where there was this trend in hijackings, plane hijackings. They were super common. Like, people try to figure out how to handle it and how to deal with the problem, and airlines are like, well, what are we supposed to do? Make everyone walk through metal detectors? And I was like, yeah, you should make them do that. That's what we do. It was weird.
I remember that. I remember this book that came out. My book club that I'm in actually read it, and I didn't. I just showed up and drank whiskey with everybody and nodded. But yeah, I've heard this is a great book. And I remember that. I remember growing up, and that was sort of understood that most, the understanding of me as a kid was, oh, most planes get hijacked. Like, most planes go to Cuba. You're pretty lucky if you don't get hijacked, right? That was sort of the feel, wasn't it?
It really was. And I was born in the late 70s, so that's so crazy to me.
Show off.
That they were like, people want to be inconvenienced by going through metal detectors. And I kept thinking, but aren't they inconvenienced when their plane is hijacked, like, and they're diverted to Cuba? But they would just pay the hijackers. That was financially sort of the easiest answer. And so it just kept happening. And there's this really lovely romantic idea that the people who do this are driven to it out of the sense that nobody is listening to them, mm-hmm. that they don't know what else to do, and they're so frustrated, and that this will be a big statement that they can make, and finally people will pay attention to them and listen to them.
You know, I feel a lot that way with this podcast, so maybe you're offering a solution here. I don't know.
They do have metal detectors now, and you take your shoes off, and it's more complicated than it was. I just was looking through it again, and some guy rode his bike up through a fence in a hole in a fence by an airline, and he was wearing a ski mask, and nobody thought it was weird until it was too late.
Wow, he hijacked from a bike to a plane. So would you recommend this book? Would you say this is a must read or should read or eh?
I love things that are weird, and so I really enjoyed reading it, and it just kept getting crazier and crazier. I thought it was fascinating. I really liked it.
Ashley, thank you so much. I appreciate that. And I appreciate you sending the Twitter out. That was really cool.
Good. It was fun. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. You know, and theater people, I mean, they're different.
Oh, they're
freaky. Not like
freaky.
Us. They kiss hello on the mouth. You know, and that's not my world. But it was for a few months.
Doug, Today's guest on The Write-Up is Doug Dorst. He is the author of the award-winning Alive in Necropolis, and also the short story collection The Surf Guru, and most recently, the New York Times bestseller S, a book which he collaborated with J.J. Abrams to write. It's a mystery, it's a love story like no other. The book's narrative primarily takes place in a series of handwritten notes in the margins of the book. It's a book that's not only a thrill to read, but it's also physically fascinating. Doug currently teaches creative writing at Texas State Creative Writing Program, and he's also a Jeopardy champion. So it's really good to have all-around talent Doug Dorst here on The Write-Up. Hi, Doug.
Thanks, Owen. It's really nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's really good. I'm glad we were able to get you in here. To get started, would you be willing to read something you've written, a portion, maybe something from... Well, probably from one of your books.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to read a piece from a short story called Little Reptiles. This is the beginning of a section that is at least ostensibly about the gharial. Mm. Each section of the story is about a different reptile. Okay. Lately, every time you finish a story, the gharial that lives under your writing desk darts out and bites off one of your toes, then scutters back into the shadows. To ask how it knows you've finished is pointless. It just does. Anyway, it's sad how little work you finish, but it's understandable. A person needs to walk, after all. When you limp into your psychiatrist's office, he asks, "What's the matter?" "I have a gharial problem," you say. You wanted to bring a photo to show him, but every shot you've taken has come out as a murky, blurred nada. The creature is surprisingly quick. Why, if it weren't for your lost toes and the dark red spatters and swirls on the hardwood floor of your office, you would doubt its existence yourself. He admits he knows next to nothing about this species of reptile, apart from the fact that gharials have narrow jaws and long snouts that are ideally suited to their piscivorous feeding habits. They're native to the Indian subcontinent, you offer, because you've looked it up, although apparently they can thrive indoors in central Texas, too. Yes, he agrees. And also, they rarely, if ever, attack humans. But if one were to, it makes a degree of sense that it would choose a writer. You ponder this. Is it because they can sense the dread in our blood? Precisely, he says. Studies have shown that dread is sweet and umami rich. He gives you a referral to a specialist, an old college roommate of his who runs a semi-licensed snake farm on a ranch road outside Wimberley. You ask if your insurance will cover your consultation with the herpaculturalist, explaining how, on account of, you know, money and your utter lack of it, and also how these days the things you get paid for, stories, require body parts from you, even if they're minor ones, etc., etc. Oh, almost certainly not, he says. But he hands you a sack full of benzodiazepines, which you interpret as an expression of empathy.
Doug Dorst reading from his short story collection, The Surf Guru. And that's a perfect example of a lot of your writing. It's haunting. It's slightly surreal. Like it's getting into the surreal. And you have this brilliant ability, something I really admire in your work, of combining humor and horror. You know, there's a lot of humor and horror kind of floating up.
One goes with the other pretty well. People have said that far more eloquently, but I believe...
Not in this room, they haven't.
Well, and I didn't start, so it's open for the next person to take it.
But is that something you're drawn to? Is that something you do intentionally? You're like, are you finding yourself writing something that's slightly horrific and bringing in the humor to extend the flavor, or is it more just like you find there's humor in the horror, or is there horror in the humor?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't think it's a strategic choice. I think it's just how I'm wired.
Yeah.
And when I'm working in a dark place, the humor tends, or, you know, what feels like humor to me presents itself. And I'm glad it does, because if you're just working in the dark place and everything is dark and horrific and dismal and sad and awful, I don't know, that's pretty monochromatic.
Yeah.
And so I like...
It's like Morrissey on a serious day. That's interesting. You know, I want to get back to that. Before I do that, there's a question I like to ask. What do you think is the first book you loved?
Wow.
I know. It's a horrible question. I would hate to be asked that question, but that's what I'm asking.
I mean, I've loved different books at different stages of my life. You know, when I was a kid, I grew up on Agatha Christie and Robert Ludlum and Stephen King.
Yeah.
I loved The Stand. I loved It.
Yeah,
And I think The Shining might be my favorite Stephen King book of all.
Mm.
I might go with those a bit later on. In college, I read Catch 22, and that blew my mind.
But this is when you're... Like, how old were you when you're reading The Stand?
It was about fourth, fifth grade was when I got into...
Gosh, I have a fourth grader as a daughter. I don't want to read The Stand.
No, and especially not The Shining. I read The Shining the summer after fourth grade, or maybe the summer going into it. At any rate, too young.
Yes.
And the scene where, you know, he goes into the room and there's a horrible festering lady in the shower.
Yes.
It made me terrified of showers and bathrooms. And it was a very hot summer. And I did not bathe because I was so scared. But of course, I couldn't explain to anybody why I couldn't bathe. And so there's just a lot of tension and smell.
And that's defined your writing career.
Yeah, pretty much.
All right, well let's get back to Doug Dorst and talking about your writing. So you were saying though you're not necessarily strategic in your choice of craft tools, more that you're discovering what's entertaining you in the moment.
I think so. Yeah, I think I used to write in a much more calculated way when I was starting out and when I was in grad school, and that worked for a little while. Mm. It worked with, you know, a few short stories. And then rather quickly, particularly when I started working on the novel, it quit working.
Mm.
And it took me a while, but I realized I had to work in a very different way. And I really had to work improvisationally to get into the flow and get out of my own way.
Yeah.
You know, I have a relentless and fast and ruthless internal editor. And I can't allow it the time or the space to do its work while I'm trying to write something.
What do you do to do that? I think that's a common thing for a lot of writers. I mean, I think there's a lot of blank pages out there that are due to internal editors. How do you give your internal editor the day off?
I've never been able to give it an entire day off. It keeps coming back. But one thing, it was a trick, is while I was in a real dead spot on the first novel, a writer friend of mine.
Your first novel being Alive in Necropolis.
Oh God, I didn't plan that.
See, that's the kind of humor just organically pops to life.
That's not going to make people buy books. We're not going to move units with that one. So there was a writer friend of mine, Ann Williams, and she suggested, just setting a timer and typing and not worrying about what the words are and not allowing yourself to stop typing.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go back. Not only can you not go back and fix stuff, you can't pause to think. You know, you got to keep fingers moving on keys. And, you make a tremendous mess when you're doing that.
Yeah.
And, you know, you might throw out 98 or 100% of it. But I found that if I could do that, then I could get some kind of if not flow, at least momentum going, and then I could ride that past, you know, the internal editor.
Mm.
I think that's, I'm a big fan of timers,
mm-hmm.
you know, and with that first novel too, is I would say, okay, I knew a scene I had to write. I'd say I have 25 minutes to block out this scene.
Yeah.
And it would come out as just, you know, dialogue and action, maybe a little gesture. And it was raw and terrible, but actually it would have a nice organic flow.
Yeah.
And I think I actually got the shapes of those scenes are so much better for my having started them by doing that than if I had been going, you know, phrase by phrase, line by line, moment, beat by beat, and really agonizing over it.
It does seem, you know, in the job of writing, it seems that there is that constant tension between, I'd say, craft and creativity, but the internal editor and then the spontaneous writer. And they both, you know, they both want to throw a party. But the editor is like, I am going to stand at the door and make sure only the the right kind of people get inside. You know, that's their job. They're patting people down and, you know, making sure no one's going to hijack the plane. And then the other guy's like, I've popped the keg and we are just anyone who wants to come in can come in. And there is that sort of balance. And it does seem that at some point you have to get the editor to take some time. Even if you say, just take half an hour break,
right,
editor, so you can get all those people into the party who normally wouldn't show up because they're like, I'm terrified of that editor. I'm this idea that's hanging out at the back of the head. And I'm like, I'm not going to show up because that editor, I'm a mess. Look at me. But I'm a weird idea about a lizard eating toes of, no way would the editor let me in. But
right.
Then the editor's on break. They sneak in. They start hanging out. Suddenly the party's better.
Yeah. And actually, the reptile story is a good example of that. I mean, I knew conceptually I had this idea. I'm going to do a story that is, it's a suite of pieces. They're all about various kinds of, anxieties and existential crises. And I'm going to have fun with the connections with the reptiles that I'm. But I didn't know exactly how that would work. I didn't know which reptiles I was going to use. I think the first one started out, the first section is titled Boom Slang, which it just started out because I thought boom slang was the coolest word I had ever heard.
Yeah.
It turns out to be a very cool snake. And then that turned, and I just started typing. And
yeah.
There's something really fun about not knowing where the hell you're going.
Yeah.
And, and sometimes it doesn't work out, but actually it works out more often than it should, it seems like.
Yeah. And it's not like you're firing the editor. The editor comes
back.
No,
the editor comes back.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually that's the thing, I don't know that we as writers and maybe as teachers of writing talk enough about just how different the processes of generating story and shaping story are. At least for me, they're entirely different parts. If I'm going to do it right, if I'm going to do each of them well, the internal editor has to be absolutely banished, at least for a little while.
Right.
While I'm generating. But he gets to come back.
Yeah.
So I'm very glad I have a tenacious internal editor who serves me well.
Yeah.
It means I don't have to spend as much money paying external editors. But they're so different. And the thing is, you're reading a story, you're reading a book, and what you're seeing, it has the illusion of having been created all at once,
right,
perfectly. And
yeah,
it's just not how it is.
Yeah. So talking about playfulness in writing and that process, and then, of course, also combining that with craftsmanship, let's talk a little bit about S.
Sure.
So S, the initial idea was J.J. Abrams, and he came to you. Describe what happened there.
Yeah, so 10 or even 15 years ago, J.J. found a copy of a book that someone had left outside LAX, and I believe it was a Ludlum book, in which someone had written a note in it, to whoever finds this book, please read it, pass it on, and that got him started thinking about how people might, not just how people commune over books, but how wouldn't it be interesting if people communicated via, a particular book. And so he got thinking about, it would be very cool to do a book that is in some way like an epistolary novel that taking place between two readers, making notes to each other in the margins of another text.
Yeah.
And he took it to Lindsay Weber, who is head of features at Bad Robot, his production company, and said, and he'd been sitting on the idea for a while. And I guess, he finally said, let's try to do it. And he said, well, who should we call for this? And she had read Alive in Necropolis, I think, when it was making the rounds for Film Options. I'm not entirely sure. It's amazing to me, but she said, let's call this guy and see what he has to say. And so the call came out of the blue from the agent saying, hey, would you possibly be interested in working with J.J. Abrams?
That must have been an interesting call to get.
You don't get calls like that
all
that often. And especially when your book has sold like 7 copies, 6 of them to your mom and 1 to your dentist. And I said, well, of course, that sounds interesting to me. And I've always been interested, too, in working with interesting formal conceits and interesting shapes and structures of stories. And I kind of like that. There's you know, a bit of the game in it. Like, yeah. How are you going to tell a story in this odd way?
Well, Surf Guru, your short story collection, has a lot of variety of styles of stories and styles of voice as well.
Forms and structures. Yeah. I don't know if they knew that, if they knew that that's something that really tickles me. I mean, Necropolis there's a chunk of Necropolis that takes place in the form of narratives in police reports.
Right.
But it's not a huge part of the book.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I said, yeah, I would love to. They said, well, here's our formal conceit. What kind of story would you tell with that? And I started putting together some thoughts about this sort of shadowy, elusive mid-20th century writer and thinking about the two people, the contemporary readers, you know, who might be interested in talking about this book and, you know, and why they would connect over it. I put together a proposal and they said, let's move ahead. And we spent the better part of a year, like, talking about character and theme and mechanics, like how the characters are going to get the book back and forth to each other.
Sure.
And also, and how the reader is going to experience this physical book that we're making.
Yeah. Just to describe the book to our listeners, we're talking to Doug Dorst, and he is the author, among other books, of S, a book that came from original idea. It was from J.J. Abrams. And I'm holding a copy of S in my hands. And the reason I am is because, unlike many books that you can experience primarily in some ways through the text, S, it, for me at least, I would call it an essentially a physical book. I know there is an ebook version, but S comes in a box, and when you take it out of the box, you'll find that Doug's name is only on the box. It does not appear on the actual book. The actual book feels and looks like a used library book. There's the library sticker on it. The pages have been yellowed. There's writing in every page on the margins. In the back of the book, there's a return by stamp. And it's filled with also postcards, receipts, handwritten letters, Xerox copies of other magazines and books. And it's a fascinating book that extends past its own pages and hints to these other stories. And it's written by V.M. Straka, the fictional V.M. Straka, and the conversation between these two readers is a lot centered on who the actual identity of this writer is, a mysterious writer. You know, I noticed some of the other writers that I've talked to, readers who've enjoyed this book, some of them have said, oh, I just want to read all the books by V.M. Straka, that there's all these books that get mentioned. Of course, he doesn't exist.
He doesn't exist. They don't exist. But it's so much fun to think of. I had so much fun, you know, thinking about his catalog or the other works that have been attributed to him or
right.
published under his name.
And some of them were kind of not maybe as good. Like, he's not some of his books were like, oh, that was
some were failures. Yeah. Some were universally derided. But it was also cool, you know, like, I actually have, you know, a sense of at least a few things about each of those books.
Yes.
And, you know, of course, it would be fun to write them. But, you know, I don't really have time to write 18 more V.M. Straka books.
You've already written one V.M. Straka book.
It wasn't even clear to me at the very beginning that I was signing on to write an entire V.M. Straka novel in addition to the novel that takes place in the margins of the V.M. After we sold the book, someone said, you realize you've just agreed to write two novels in this really short time frame. And I thought, oh, God, I did not think that through.
And two, I mean, voices-wise, you've got the voice of V.M. Straka, the printed text. And then you have the voice of these two readers. You have the voices of different articles, a college newspaper. There's so many voices.
And the translator. There's a translator who's annotating, translator/editor, annotating Straka's book. So, yeah, I mean, it's a cacophonous experience, yeah. You know, by design. But that's so much fun.
Yeah.
Like, one of the most fun things you can do as a writer is assume someone else's voice.
Yes.
You know, and have fun with it.
This book has a lot of curves and corners and mysteries and threads that work really well together. That must have been a challenge to be balancing all of those and keeping all of those in mind, these different storylines, these different mysteries, and even how it mechanically fits together. while simultaneously allowing yourself like the freedom to just write a chapter. How did you manage that?
Well, I think it was, I was encouraged by JJ and Lindsay to take the chances that I needed to take. And so, you know, after we sold the book on the basis of the foreword and the first chapter.
Okay.
And then after that, and when we sold it, it was the Straka book text, Straka's novel Ship of Theseus, foreword in chapter one, and the two contemporary readers, Eric and Jen, their notes in the margins. After we sold it, then I wrote the rest of Ship of Theseus all the way through. And I didn't, a lot of it was improvisation and exploration. I didn't know all of the threads in advance. A lot of the threads presented themselves as I was writing. And, you know, there was a lot that got figured out just in the writing of it. And I was lucky that I knew that I had JJ and Lindsay and our editor, Josh Kendall at Little Brown, who would help me clean up, or not just clean up the mess that I was making, but like, you know, if I had trouble kind of hammering what I had come up with into shape, I had really good story minds who would help me. I guess minds don't hammer my, but you know where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
So what am I saying? It might seem hard to believe, but a lot of it was improvised, and a lot of it was, you know, I don't know what chapter seven's going to be. I know a thing about it. Let me just go. You know, some things worked well, some things didn't and had to be thrown out and redone. Mm-hmm. But again, on the whole, I think the improvisational instinct, / deadline pressure, served me well there.
You know, I want to ask you a little bit about Straka. So when I was first reading this book, reading S, you know, even in the foreword, there's this conversation of who Straka is and all the things he may or may have done, including starting revolutions, protests, assassination, wild possibilities of who this person is. And as a writer myself, I was like, yeah, that's who writers are. We change the world. And my day-to-day life sometimes says different. But I wanted to ask you about the myth of the writer. You know, it seemed also, I could get along very well with Jen and Eric, because there is something about like, oh yeah, I want to know everything about a writer. They are mythic personalities. To me, I'm like, I can be obsessed with Hemingway. Like, ooh, what did Hemingway write on his note cards? And ooh, talk about that, the myth of the writer and how that impacted the approach of this book.
Well, I mean, I guess I started with one of the reasons that I went with the Straka idea to begin with is that I'd been reading a book called Contested Will, which was all about the Shakespeare authorship controversy, which again is fascinating. I think Harper's did like a 30 piece sequence about the Shakespeare authorship. I mean, it's like 100 pages long. Well, I'm exaggerating. Anyway, it was long, and I read the whole thing and was fascinated by it all.
Right. Who wrote the plays?
Yeah. And you know, there's mystery in there, and I think, and it's because you, like as you were suggesting, you want to connect this person to these works that speak to you emotionally and that have spoken to our culture in really important ways. So I thought, yeah, an authorship mystery is interesting to me, and I came across where I had known a little bit about the writer B. Traven. It was another sort of big authorship mystery figure. And he was mostly writing in like the 20s and 30s. And he was, you know, he was a kind of left-wing revolutionary guy. And, you know, I thought, yeah, Straka should be that, but more. Straka should be someone who did what Traven did, but was really dangerous and terrified people, and people were right to be terrified by him. And he may or may not have done all of the things that you know he was accused of doing.
Right.
You know, and part of that uncertainty is part of the juiciness of the myth. But I thought, yeah, like, let me, you know, put him at the center of so many important moments.
Yeah.
And at the center of so many important tensions in the first half of the 20th century.
It did seem in the first half of the 20th century that writers were doing that. It's, I mean, perhaps not to the extent that Straka could or could have maybe was doing, but there does seem to be like, oh, you know, Hemingway was going, like, it's World War II, I'm going to go over and just... I'm going to say I'm reporting, but maybe I'm just going to join the troops and help retake Paris. Why not?
Right. I mean, I think I've, and that may have, it's probably something that I've been wrestling with. Like, mm-hmm. you know, okay, I'm a novelist.
Yeah.
To what degree do I have like a political responsibility to make my work right. Resonate or be important somehow? To what, you know, is it enough to entertain? Is it enough? You know, what do I want to do? And what are my obligations? So, yeah, this is probably like a little bit of fantasy wish fulfillment, getting to inhabit the life of a writer who knew what he believed in.
Yeah.
And acted.
Yeah, lived radically.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and suffered for it, but other people and other institutions suffered
yeah.
because of his efforts.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if I'm still, I want to write stuff that's important. I don't know that I have yet, or I'm not sure I know how to do it.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing. I mean, it also makes me think, and I'd love to know your thought about this too, of just writers whose, you know, sometimes their lives overshadow their works. There's a few writers working today who could probably fall into that category, and filmmakers as well. But I wonder about that. You know, I'm a sucker. I'm a sucker for reading about Paris in the 1920s. I'm a sucker about reading about Kerouac and his adventures with Ginsberg, and they're running around, you know, New York and Times Square in the 1950s. And I love hearing the stories of how writers are living, even if it's not necessarily with a political aspect, but living in a radical sort of way, and that's impacting their writing. And hearing those stories and reading about the stories impacts the way I read their fiction. Does it seem that maybe, and maybe this is a leading question, that writers are getting a little quieter in the way we live?
Oh, I don't know. We're probably on the whole better behaved than we used to be.
Yeah.
You know, I guess.
Maybe we can get away with less.
I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
It's interesting because you can, and people do make the argument that the identity of the writer and the life of the writer and even the intentions of the writer should matter not one bit.
Right.
That it's all just, it should be the text. And I was playing with that a little bit too.
Yes.
Because
you know, the identity of the writer is unclear. It could be multiple people. Which, yeah.
Right. And
that's in the book S.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what's important are the works and the politics advanced by the works, not the personal lives of, you know, the author credited as V.M. Straka.
Yeah. Well, that said, you personally, Doug, are there any writers throughout history that you're like, oh, I sure would have liked to hang out with him or hung out with her for a while?
Oh, I mean, it would have been great to be in Paris
yeah.
with all of those people. I don't know that I could have kept up with them.
Most of them didn't keep up with them.
Yeah, exactly. I'll go with that. That seems like a good period.
Yeah.
A lot of smart people doing interesting work in a fun place, playing by their own rules.
Yeah.
So...
Oh, we're talking to Doug Dorst, author of the novel Live in Necropolis, The Surf Guru, and S. Doug teaches creative writing at Texas State. I wanted to talk to you a little bit, working with J.J. Abrams, and I know you've worked also in screenplay working. But what are the other areas that you are excited about writing within, besides traditional prose?
I've written a play.
Yeah.
It was produced in 08 or 09. It was a collaboration with Fool's Fury Theater Company. In San Francisco. It's a group that I did some dramaturgy with them. And I mean, I did a lot of stuff with them. We finally said, let's write a play. And
yeah.
I said, I don't know how to write plays. I'm not a playwright. And they said, great. You know, we'll turn that into, you know, we'll make that a strength of it.
How was that? Was that fun?
It was a blast. And it was actually, and it came when I was In yet another dead spot on the novel and feeling really bad about myself as a writer. Mm. This is the first novel.
Alive in Necropolis.
Yeah. And it was a devised piece, so there would be a lot of actor improvisation, and I would, like, take bits and riff on them and then feed it back to them, and they would riff on that. And so different from sitting in a room with your novel. You are the only person who knows what your novel needs to do, and right. It is all on you. As opposed to working collaboratively with theater people on a devised piece.
Yeah.
You know, and theater people, I mean, they're different.
Oh, they're
freaky. Not like
freaky.
Us. They kiss hello on the mouth, you know, and that's not my world, but it was for a few months. And it was a blast. The play came out well, people enjoyed it. We had a blast doing it. And it also gave me, you know, the momentum and probably the confidence that I needed to get back in and finish the novel.
Yeah.
But I really needed to just get out of my head.
Sure.
And get away from the worry.
Kiss some people in the mouth.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That'll do it. Well, you've been listening to The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton. Our guest today has been novelist and short story writer Doug Dorst. It's been fascinating talking to you. And thanks so much for sharing a lot about your process, about your career, and about your approach to the written word.
Cool. Thanks for having me. This is a blast.
Thanks, Doug. The Write-Up is a KUT production. Our producer is Rebecca McEnroy. Our engineer is David Alvarez. This whole, actually, episode of The Write-Up goes out to Trix the Rat.
R.I.P.
Yeah. I'm Owen Edgerton. Thanks so much for listening.